This is Cultural Baggage. I'm Dean Becker, and today we take a look at opiates, addiction, and death in America.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting.
From the master, Johnny Cash, that's Hurt. The relentless marketing of pain pills. Crews from one small Mexican town selling heroin like pizza. The collision has led to America's greatest drug scourge, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic, Dreamland, written by Mr. Sam Quinones, who is with us today. Hello, Sam.
How you doing, Dan? How's it going?
Look, I want to say something about this book. This is something every politician in America should read.
I was working for the LA Times in 2009, and I was working on drug stories because of the drug war and the violence in Mexico. They wanted me to work on stories about how drugs are trafficked from Mexico across the United States, once it got in the United States. And I found these stories of these folks dying of overdoses to black tar heroin in the town of Huntington, West Virginia. And that really is what caught my eye. First of all, black tar heroin had never been east of the Mississippi River that I knew. What was West Virginia doing with lots of heroin addicts, you know, and what was it doing with enough heroin to kill so many people over a sustained period of time? I think there was a dozen fatal overdose deaths in 6 months in that town. And that got me various phone calls later, came upon a DEA agent who kind of changed my life, really, for the next several years. He said, yeah, we had no heroin. We had zero heroin in Columbus 10 years ago. And then these Mexican guys began arriving and driving around and delivering it like pizza. So you, an addict, would call a phone number, an operator would be standing by to take your order, and then would dispatch a driver. They had several drivers tooling around Columbus, their mouths filled with little balloons of tenth of a gram doses of heroin, and they would deliver it to you. It was like customer service heroin, the Domino's pizza of heroin, basically. And they also, he told me, very quiet. They don't use guns. We've never caught any of them with a gun. They don't show their money. They're not flashy. They're very savvy about customer service and giving discounts and giving dope away in front of methadone clinics and all this stuff. And then he told me they're all from the same town. And that really got me going. And I eventually found guys to tell me that, yes, this one town, Jalisco Nayarit, the town of Jalisco, in the small little state of Nayarit, Mexico, had developed this system. It was a kind of a heroin franchise system. And they had taken it all across the country. And it was the only drug trafficking group that I'd ever encountered that didn't sell just wholesale. Most drug trafficking organizations out of Mexico, they don't want to sell retail. It's far too risky. But these guys had developed a system for selling retail and using, you know, cheap Mexican labor. And the guys around the area where they were from would raise their hands and to be paid a salary to drive heroin in their mouths all around town, waiting for calls from the operator to go deliver heroin.
Yeah.
And this was all part of this system. It was like a franchise system, and they had used it to spread from the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles coast to coast. They were in Charlotte, they were in Columbus, and so on. And it was this amazing system, and I began to write about that and investigate that and talk to guys who've been arrested participating in that. But the big question was one of those that I had originally, and that was, why was there any heroin demand in West Virginia at all? I mean, it was not a state that I associated with heroin, and that's what brought me to the pain revolution in America and Purdue Pharma and the acceptance by doctors that we're a country in pain and need to be treated with pain pills.
And Sam, and yeah, you're coming back to
why those people from Mexico were here selling at retail, because the doctors had been led to believe that these pain pills were non-addictive, that they wouldn't have to escalate their dosage, et cetera, et cetera. But most, if not all of that, proved to be untrue, did it not?
I mean, it varied. It wasn't that it was 100% untrue, but it certainly varied enough. They were in this pain revolution that really took place in the late 80s and accelerated dramatically in the 1990s. The idea was that we were a country in pain, that doctors had a moral duty to treat that pain, and at the same time, coincidentally or not, insurance companies were ratcheting back on the variety of treatments that they would reimburse, leaving doctors who were now being told that they had to treat pain with very few tools with which to treat it. At the same time, as you say, the idea emerged, coincidentally or not, I think it kind of all kind of meshed together in some big juggernaut that was very difficult to stop, that said, we now know that these are narcotic, opiate painkillers. We now know, though, that they are non-addictive when used for pain, to treat pain. And the truth is that for some people that's true, and it just, the problem is trying to figure out who's who is extraordinarily difficult. And so, and particularly when these pills were accepted as non-addictive, I believe the term was less than 1% of all pain patients get addicted to these pills. That was nonsense. That was based on the shabbiest of evidence they now recognize, but that was what was accepted, and it was accepted by doctors from coast to coast, every part of America. Doctors accepted this idea that this was that they now could risk-free prescribe these pills, these narcotics, these opiate painkillers for all manner of pain, and so people began getting these pills after having their wisdom teeth extracted, say, or for an appendix operation, and on like that. And the problem is that there was a huge run-up in supply of pills, and that created also more recreational use. So you had two forms of addiction taking place simultaneously. One was people using it recreationally because there were so many pills in medicine cabinets all across America. A lot of that leaked out into high school kids' parties and whatnot, a lot of those kids got addicted. And then the other way was, contrary to the belief, that people getting addicted by using the pills precisely as they were prescribed for pain, and still they got addicted. And there's a significant number of those folks as well. And the thing is that those pills are molecularly, they're all opiates. They're all opiate painkillers. They're molecularly very similar to heroin. And so when those pills, either the supply gets cut off or the price rises so much that you can't afford it, you're spending all your money, the pills on the street were a dollar a milligram, then the transition to heroin became very quick. And that's what we're seeing. We've been seeing that for 20 years, really. It's been hidden. But it's accelerated in the last 3 or 4 years, and that's what we're seeing all across the country now. That's why you have now heroin addiction in Alabama and heroin addiction in Vermont and Tennessee and places like that, where you never would have associated heroin, states you never would have associated with heroin, like West Virginia, perfect example. And now you've got it everywhere, and that is why, as it's in the book, it's a great day to be a heroin dealer in America. I think what's happened here is that, you know, first of all, heroin is a drug that turns everyone who gets addicted to it into a narcissistic, self-absorbed individual, just enclosed in on him or herself, a hyper-consumer. It's a person who thinks only about one thing, and that is buying something that'll make him feel good every day, 3 or 4 times a day. The way this really emerges is when there is, frankly, a shredding of community. Community is the antidote to heroin. And the way it spreads is in lack of community. And the town that I focused on had that community shredded for 25 years. Opiates make just quick work of a town where community has been shredded. And that is really a larger point of Dreamland, of my book, to say that is how you create a widespread heroin epidemic, by shredding community. And that's what's happened. It's not only happened in poor communities, though. If you go to wealthy communities where this is a problem as well, you'll see people don't, congregate. They don't know each other. They have very large houses. they don't even see each other in the middle of the day probably sometimes because the houses sometimes are so large, you know. There's not a lot of community feel to it, and when you have that, it's already a very isolating life. Well, then heroin can creep in there as well very easily.
You know, and meantime, the Purdue Pharmaceutical Company is literally making billions of dollars off of these pills.
Yeah, right. Purdue was a key part in this pain revolution for a couple of reasons. One was it ran with the idea that these pills were non-addictive. It had there were pain specialists who were saying that. The pill companies were not the first to say this. The pain specialists were the first to say, when used for pain, these pills are virtually non-addictive. They're less than 1% non-addictive. Purdue just happened to be the company in the mid-90s to come out with a pain pill that was time relief. And so you didn't need to, and for pain specialists, it looked like as fantastic news. You no longer needed to take 6 or 8 Vicodin a day, 1 every 2 or 3 hours. You could take 2 OxyContin, and it would be time released into your system over the next, you take 1 in the morning and 1 in the evening, and that was all you needed. And that was not a trivial thing. I mean, people did, you know, have their lives dominated, pain patients did have their lives dominated by having to watch the clock and always take the pills on time and this kind of thing. So it was an important thing. The difference was, though, I think that Purdue marketed this as if it was over the counter medicine. It was an opiate, but they marketed it as an over the counter medicine, and they really to doctors. They wanted to convince doctors that it was now okay for you, doctor, to prescribe this pill for almost any kind of pain that you encountered during the day. And it was they did this through a variety of mechanisms. The first 5-6 years of OxyContin's life, you know, they had phone pads and pens and caps and the Scottsdale in Florida. They had a CD called Swing in the Right Direction with OxyContin. And it was a collection of swing tunes, Count Basie and Woody Herman and that kind of thing. They marketed this heavily, but really what they were doing was marketing on the idea that these pain specialists, who are viewed rightly or wrongly as independent, we're saying, look, this is what we need. We need to treat pain, and we need tools to treat pain. The insurance companies are cutting back on a variety of other more holistic ways of treating pain, very expensive therapy, acupuncture, et cetera. Sometimes they were paying for these kinds of things. And so what are we left with? We're left with only pills, and these pills, and OxyContin comes along right at that time. And they're still selling billions. You know, the Forbes, I believe it was, or Fortune, lifted the three brothers bought OxyContin in the 1950s, and it's now a multi-billion-dollar corporation based entirely on OxyContin, really. And one of the lone remaining brother is now one of the world of our top billionaires. I believe he is number 16th or 14th in the number of billions that he has accumulated because of this. The company has reformulated OxyContin, but the problem is that this is still an attitude in the United States that pain needs to be dealt with no matter what the cost, and that when you go in for a surgery or something like that, you are given, your listeners are probably, many of them have had this happen, going for a minor surgery, an incision, I had an appendix out a while back, they gave me 60 Vicodin in a bottle to take home with me. Now, the message in that bottle is that message of the pain revolution, which is these pills are non-addictive when used to treat pain. And the truth is, you don't know that. Everybody's different. For me, I didn't have a problem. I took 2 and left them in the medicine cabinet for 3 years, then realized what I had, and I threw them away. But not everybody is like that. A lot of people get addicted to these things very quickly, and I've met many who have had that happen.
You know, we've had many treatment centers pop up purporting to cure these people of their problems, but in many cases that's just not true, right?
Well, treatment of addiction is a mysterious thing. It's not. It depends on the human being, and there's a variety of ways of addressing it. I think as a country we'd be well served to not say that there's only one way to treat addiction. On the other hand, there are treatment centers that pop up offering Suboxone, which is a new combination drug that prevents you from overdosing. And Now, this drug has got an opiate in it as well, but it's also it's a drug that can be abused, and if you don't regulate it, if you don't watch it closely, and that's what's happened. Sometimes it's been abused. On the other hand, sometimes people can't find it legitimately, and they're trying to stay away from heroin, and so they buy it on the street. One thing I have noticed, learned from all this, is that the more you treat a problem with only one solution, the more likely you are to create significant problems for yourself. That's what we tried to do with pain. A doctor in the book said, if you treated cancer in only all cancers in only one way, it would mean you really didn't understand the specific cancer that you were trying to treat. And I think the same is true of pain, and the same is also true of addiction. We need a wide variety of responses to this problem now. We also need to start holding the private sector accountable for what they've started. Remember, this is the only drug scourge since World War II that was not started by drug mafias, by street gangs and street dealers. It was started by legitimate medicine, well-meaning doctors, many of them, but who made a fundamental error encouraged to do so by pain specialists and the pharmaceutical companies. But it was started by legitimate medicine, not by the street underworld. And that's why it's such a difficult thing to change, because so many people still think that way, that we should treat this pain with only one solution. Those pills can be part of a solution, there's no doubt. But when it's the only thing that you provide to everybody, then you get the situation where we find ourselves in today. And the rise of heroin is now directly related to that.
At many of these treatment centers get the insurance money, or they get all the money that the parents may have available, and that many times the patient is kicked out or released before they have actually learned how to get off of these pills, right?
Well, this is what we're learning is, I think, that the old solutions that would have served for alcoholism or maybe other drugs do not work so much for opiates and heroin. And that is because those drugs change the brain in fundamental ways that perhaps the others do not. In fact, I believe now, after talking with numerous recovering addicts and doctors and whatnot, that really you need about a year of treatment, and that's isolation from the drug to let your brain rebound. Sometimes people even need more, like 2 years. That's kind of what we've gotten ourselves into now. To get people off these drugs, 28 days is a joke. There's no chance. 3 months is also similarly impossible. It just won't happen. 6 months, you're beginning to see some possibility. Really, though, I think 9 months to a year, year and a half. That's how long it takes to fully kind of get your brain and your behavior patterns back them off of all the damage that you've done by using these drugs, by blasting them daily with huge doses of opiates. And that's kind of what we're seeing. This is overwhelmed. Yes, it's true that there's some scandalous treatment centers out there. It's also true, though, that people have an unrealistic expectation of how quickly someone should be able to recover, in quotes. It's just a huge amount of expense that we've gotten ourselves into. And yet the other option is basically continue the life of addiction, enslavement. The best you can hope for is a life of low expectations. The worst, of course, is overdose. And so it's a tough situation we find ourselves in.
All right, friends, we've been speaking with Mr. Sam Quinones. He's author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Sam, any closing thoughts, website you'd like to share?
You can find more about my work at my website, which is samquinones.com.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Birth defects, miscarriage, premature birth, feeling sad, anxious or empty, irritability, anger, loss of pleasure or interest, sleeping too much or too little, depression, trouble concentrating, suicide. Time's up. The answer, Accutane for acne. Another FDA-approved product.
Really proud to have with me the director of A New Path, Ms. Gretchen Burns Bergman.
It's A New Path, and the PATH stands for Parents for Addiction Treatment and Healing. And we actually started in 1999 at the time that I had a son who had addiction problems, and he had been incarcerated for possession of marijuana, which started an 11-year cycling in and out of jail prison as his addiction developed. He actually learned to shoot heroin behind bars. So we knew, and it was a group of, there were three parents that started this, we knew that our kids were not getting the help that they needed, but instead they were being treated by a criminal justice system that absolutely exacerbated the problem and really stole years of their life, and in some cases, it led to, overdose deaths and loss of, if you've been convicted of a felony, loss of all kinds of rights, including sometimes housing and education and that kind of thing. So we started with the idea of therapeutic justice. We wanted to treat rather than incarcerate, and then it developed a whole host of more harm reduction strategies that reduce the harm rather than criminal policies, and developed a deep belief that we have to stop stigmatizing people for using drugs or for being addicted to drugs, and that we have to stop criminalizing them, certainly. We're losing generations of people to mass incarceration and to overdose deaths because so many people are afraid to call 911. We started in 2010 a national campaign called Moms United to End the War on Drugs as a way of really expanding our work and working with partners, family members, mothers, and others who were doing this work or who were of like mind and needed a vehicle to really speak out. And we're seeing that parents are really making some changes by not sitting by silently as our families and our loved ones are being destroyed, lives are being destroyed, but instead speaking out. So that's the nature of the organization, stop the stigmatization, criminalization of people who use drugs or who develop problems with drugs.
Many of these treatment centers, if you will, are set up, in essence, to fleece the parents or the subjects. They set them up for a 30-day treatment, a 60-day treatment, but as soon as that money runs out, they're out the door, and that's not the true solution to this, is it?
Not at all, and you're talking to a mother who knows this firsthand because, as a parent, you're willing to do anything and everything to save the lives of your kids, and I knew that this was a life-threatening disease. My son's survived overdose a couple of times, and I actually have two sons who both developed heroin addiction, and between them, I've probably sent them to 12, 14 different facilities, and of course, that's a lot of money. I could have sent them to the best colleges in the country, I can't say that I resent the money that I've spent because I feel like each time there was at least another tool in their toolbox for them to try to find recovery, and my elder son has been in recovery for almost 13 years, and my younger son has 7 months right now, and there's a lot of people making money without really having solid answers or reasons why they should be charging so much money. And of course, you nailed it. You can't do this in 30 days, and because of insurance and all the players in this, they've reduced the time so drastically that it's almost impossible to sustain recovery after you get clean, if you will, abstinence for a month.
All right, folks, we've been speaking with Gretchen Burns Bergman of A New Path. Gretchen, please, closing thoughts and your website.
Our website is www.momsunited.net, and you can link to the PATH website through that.
From the organization Broken No More, this is their director, Denise Cullen.
Well, we do several things. Broken No More is an advocacy organization where we're trying to stop the drug war and to change punitive policies about drugs. We are working on reducing the stigma, which will enable us to do much more when people start thinking of people with addiction and substance use disorder, and even people who just use drugs as humans instead of as something other. And a big part of what we do is working with families and friends of people who have died from substance use or overdose. August 31st is the actual day for International Overdose Awareness, and every year we and other people that are interested in this issue across the world hold events, and on August 30th we are going to have a vigil and a rally to not only mourn and remember the people that we love that have died, but to bring awareness to the epidemic and to all of the failed policies to try to improve things, you know, for all of us, even those of us who have not been touched yet. We'll be on the Huntington Beach Pier in Orange County, California, probably about 200 of us at this, and we'll have a candlelight vigil. We'll walk the length of the pier. It'll start with a press conference, several people making remarks initially from many organizations that will be represented. The goal is to get people to understand the severity of this problem, in addition to a way for all of us who have lost someone to remember them.
You lost your son, correct?
Right. My son, Jeff, was 27 years old when he died in 2008 of an overdose of morphine and Xanax after he had been released from jail. He had been there 4 months on a nonviolent drug charge, and he died 2 days later. And part of the reason these things are happening is this is a very common story, out of treatment or out of jail, any period of sobriety, and your tolerance just is not the same. And when people use again, they often die, and they think they know what they're doing, and oftentimes they don't. But the issue is now we have naloxone availability, and we have Good Samaritan laws that can help prevent these needless deaths, but no one talks to people about this. The treatment centers, they don't seem to want to discuss it because maybe it looks like a failure on their part that they're expecting the person to go out and use. And the jails, I think the people in the jails just don't care. They should have an exit interview by a medical person who knows what they're talking about, a non-judgmental person that can educate them about overdose, about tolerance, about naloxone, you know, teaching their family and friends, you know, with literature or however they want to do that, to recognize an overdose so we can stop all these people from dying needlessly.
Please, your website.
It's broken-know-more.org, and the grieving part of what we do is Grasp Help. That's GRASPHELP.org. And also I'd like to say that we are at 100 chapters now, over 100 chapters across the U.S. and Canada for our grief support face-to-face groups. So please go there and check that out.
Last week, we carried a segment featuring Dr. Sue Sisley, who spoke about the 22 U.S. veterans who take their own lives every day in America. This week, it struck close to home. An Afghan veteran, the former Marine who was a fellow firefighter at my son's firehouse, took his own life. Jason M. Anderson died on August 23rd. His family requested that donations be made to his favorite charity, the J.J. Watt Foundation.
That's about all we have time for. I'm hoping that this show helps you comprehend just how stupid this drug war is, and as always, I remind you, because of Prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
If I could start a